And welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the second hour. We're talking with Cliff High about the signs of the collapsing empire, Bitcoin, and of course, new arising viable alternatives in the do-it-yourself, if you will, culture. Before we proceed to some of the other developments here, Cliff, you said previously that there will be about 21 million Bitcoin issued in total, and this will stop sometime in the future. What tell us a little bit more about that. What reasoning is behind that?
The reasoning is that the currency for a free people cannot be inflationary. And so, in fact, it must be deflationary and must become more valuable over time. And this allows a type of growth that we've never, ever seen before on this planet. And so it was decided that the number 21 million by, we won't go into the details, but 21 million provides a certain level of support for the planet as a whole with a population of 10 billion. It supplies an excellent level of support with a population at 17 billion. So it's prepared to grow, even though the number of Bitcoins don't grow. Now, it was decided they would be fixed and they would be able to be mined relative to the work and the algorithm. Now, there's one other mathematic issue that comes into it. If one is looking for prime numbers or any algorithm based off of prime numbers, the more you look, the fewer you find. And because the spaces between them, so to speak, become larger within the numeric stream, if that makes any sense. And so you have to look harder to find numbers that are further and further out. So as Bitcoin grows and its need for these numbers grow, if it were to allow to grow too much larger than 21 million, you would reach a point of diminishing returns to where the effort required to mine and create the 22nd million Bitcoin would take up as much effort as had existed in all the previous Bitcoins. Make sense? Just trying to find those next series of numbers within the algorithm. And so 21 million was a very good effective compromise. Now, it also, because these can be digitally divided basically infinitely, but even down to the 100,000th level with no worries in Satoshis, it becomes a good medium of exchange at the Satoshi level for the whole planet. And so it actually is very accommodating to the Asian sense of how money should work. And this is why I think it's been adopted so readily by the Chinese and other Asian populations, because they understand the nature of currency in two different fashions that are not really evident in the West, one of which is the need for person-to-person exchanges in low levels. And then there's the need for the storehouse of wealth that can be easily moved in large amounts. And so gold becomes cumbersome if you have a lot of it, right? Or even silver becomes just really heavy. But you would need silver to, you know, aid your cousin down the street, that kind of thing. But if you're going to be traveling across country, you don't want to be lugging that stuff with you. And so they've actually had a paper currency system devised that's basically two-tier from the very beginning and has been for the last three or four times that the Chinese have had paper currency. And in this, we see a relationship between the yuan and the renminbi that is not like the dollar and the subunits of the pennies. It is much more like the Bitcoin and the Satoshi relationships. And rather, I don't want to get into be it too esoteric, but the Chinese are going to resonate with Bitcoin, and Western minds are going to find it a little bit hard to accept how it's all going to work. Because, for instance, the Western mind is predisposed to think of the unit of measure of currency as being finitely divisible. Okay, this is, there's no real reason that should exist that way. Better, the currency should be always escalating in value, but infinitely divisible, so that you can always keep using smaller and smaller portions as it spreads out among the population. And in our sense of the understanding of currency, how do we judge socially those individuals that have a lot of it? Even if they get there through crime, we idolize them, okay? The society, not we, you and I particularly, but the society would have us idolize anybody who's got a lot of money. And that's the way it's all presented in any kind of media for the last, 100 years? Well, let's say since the 1930s depression. There we had true egalitarianism with a rise from the social order hit the mainstream. But after that, it was all about becoming more rich and more wealthy and the worship of the currency and the dollar. Now, and so you would have accumulation. In this case, though, the way Bitcoin works, Bitcoin is stronger the more distributed it becomes. And we will see over time that those individuals that become the early great hoarders simply through chance or divine insight of Bitcoin will also end up being those people that will, I think, in a very short period of time, be some of those that will be most rapidly dispensing it into the populations. So unlike with the dollars or any other currency you care to name, where everybody just wants to aggregate more and more and more, in this case, the beauty of Bitcoin is that the ones you have are increased in value by your using some of them at once we reach a certain point within its spread throughout the populace. Once it becomes a little bit more motile in terms of acting as a currency exchange, just because more of us are using it, these new characteristics of Bitcoin will emerge. And we're not seeing them yet, but they're going to be really fantastic. So a fascinating subject. I mean, you get into the mathematics of it and the algorithm and stuff, and I could go for days into the discussion of some of the social ramifications I see just emerging from this line of thought. But most people would, you know, say, oh, shut up, shut up.
Well, the point that they mentioned is really good about there will never be inflation with this currency because they can't, at some point they can't print more just like the feds do. But again, who is regulating that? Who's deciding that?
No one's regulating it. The algorithm, the idea, it's like it's mathematics. Okay. So here's the idea. Actually, let's credit where credit is due. This is Max Keiser's phrase. Okay. He says that money is precious metals. Okay. Gold is a precious metal and it's a form of money. Bitcoin is a form of money because of precious numbers. And so within the algorithm, if you don't change the algorithm, Bitcoin remains unchanged. So if you say 2 + 2 = 4, it'll always be 4. And basically what we've got here is a situation where we're hunting for precious numbers, these particular sets of primes. And it's been determined by the algorithm from which the blockchain is coded, the open source algorithm from which all of this springs, determines the finite nature of Bitcoin. Now, what has changed recently was the original estimation was that it would take until 2041 to generate the last Bitcoin. But with the new ASICs machines and multiple processing mining operations, we may be able to achieve the last Bitcoin some significant years earlier, maybe as many as 6 or 8. But not much more than that.
So there's no one that can go in and hack this. There's no back door here from the algorithm developer or those who set up the first servers for this? No?
No. NSA and CIA and stuff have stolen a lot of Bitcoins in the process. They got really pissed when they saw this developing. But they were smart and they stole some in the beginning.
The Silk Road thing, right?
No, that was recent. That was the FBI. That was the FBI getting their cut. Okay. NSA stole a bunch in the very beginning in 2009. CIA got wind of it in late 2010, early 11, and they stole a smaller amount. And then the FBI got these little dribs and drabs from Silk Road. Mm-hmm. There's no way to hack the blockchain because it's being used continuously by all these other computers. There is a theoretic way if all of the miners got together in a consortium and decided to be not honest, they could control Bitcoin in terms of the price and the flow of it. But that's about all you could have occur. And there's a demographic that won't allow that to occur. And that is that there's some kid in China that hasn't heard about it yet that's going to get an old PS2 and some bits and pieces, and it's going to hack together a chunk of hardware to do some mining off of the phone, and he's going to power it with his bicycle. And he's going to be honest, okay? And you're going to get the same thing with a guy in Africa and, you know, some kid in Alaska, because these guys see this as an opportunity to use this old cast-off hardware to slowly make, you know, a few Bitcoins, which at that point will be worth a whole lot in their local currency. And it'll be wildly economic for them to do so. And there will be no incentive for the small miner to collude in any kind of Bitcoin oppressive organization. So there's actually a social engineering tendency away from that. And that's the only flaw I've found in it, was that if a certain level of the miners did get together, they could be coercive of the blockchain. But other than that, you can't hack it. You could kill it if you could kill all of the internet and all the computers on the planet.
So it's an agreement of those people who have gone in and purchased and traded, and that's what gives the value to it.
Oh, that's the confidence in it is what gives the value to the money. Okay. Yeah. But there's no agreement. I did not agree in any way, shape, or form to the nature of the blockchain. and the Bitcoin that rides on it. Okay. I just stumbled on the algorithm, saw the beauty of it, and agreed that the designer's goals were met by the algorithm and the expression of the code that's being offered in the open source community. There were a lot of people like myself, people who read code, and we're all saying, damn, this is elegant. And we started developing our own stuff based on the elegance that we saw within the Satoshi's algorithms. So there's no agreement. We just all have accepted the work that Satoshi Nakamura did and its initial implementations in the open source community.
Right, right.
Now, everybody else since then is finding that, oh, hey, well, actually, I think a lot of it's being driven by greed. A lot of individuals are saying, oh, I can buy a Bitcoin now and convert it into some other currency later on and, quote, make a profit. There's a hardcore group of us, though, that see this as a revolutionary technology, and we're evangelizing it out there. And that's my purpose of it. It will kill the Fed and it will change the planet. And if some people become rich in the process, that's bound to occur no matter what happens because
well, so
of any
what?
Power
you know,
shift.
You know. So what? Yeah.
It's, exactly.
There's differences out there. People will never be equal in an egalitarian system. I wouldn't want to live in that kind of world. It would be a nightmare, to be honest.
Exactly. So. We'd all be earthworms. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so there could be a similar currency that can prop up as well that are built on the same or similar principles as well, correct?
Correct. In fact, there's been a number of cryptocurrencies developed since Bitcoin. The biggest follower on Bitcoin's heels is a currency called Litecoin that trades on different exchanges and has a much less of an infrastructure. In other words, that's the big gain that Bitcoin has over all other cryptocurrencies at the moment, is that you can pay for gasoline, restaurants, rent, rental, you know, go to space with them, go to Cyprus University, buy electronics, bid in on the assassination of Bernanke and pay for any of this kind of stuff with Bitcoin. Litecoin and some of the others don't have the infrastructure just yet for that. However, it is necessary in the growing nature of the planet and the nature of the limited cryptocurrencies that there be others. So Bitcoin will not be the end of it. It is an idea, and this is merely the beginning of the process.
All right. Very interesting. Now, before we shift focus a little bit here, Cliff, is there anything else you want to mention about Bitcoin that might be important to know about for those who want to buy or purchase or keep an eye on or something like that?
If you haven't got a strong stomach, Bitcoin as an investment is going to just cause you all kinds of problems, because it is very much likely to. And you say, is there anything else I want to mention? It's like, well, how many hours do we want to devote to?
Oh, I know.
But there is something from a very personal level, okay? Mm-hmm. My mother should not be in Bitcoin, because she would wake up in the morning and faint twice before breakfast just in the shifts, all right? As people become involved with Bitcoin, and as people unload Bitcoin to take those profits in their local currency or just to satisfy local needs, there's wild swings in the prices. So you could literally have a 50 or 60% downswing in a day and have it recovered in minutes later, and then swing down again that much in a day. So from that perspective, it's not gameable. You can't day trade it. You can buy it and hold it and use it. And if you're buying it to sell, then don't look at the price until you absolutely decide you have to sell based on some other criteria, because the prices are going to vary so widely and wildly that you may decide when it's at, say, in my local currency, say I wanted to sell a Bitcoin at 1,000. Well, it'd be awful hard for me to sell it at that price, because the structure of the exchanges is such, by the time I actually put in my sell order for that, it may be higher or lower by $200, simply because this is a free global market. This will stabilize. This is a growth period that is inevitable, and it actually matches in terms of growth periods similar effects with first stock exchanges and all other kinds of things. And no, this is not a Ponzi scheme. It's not a tulip bubble scheme. This is a cryptocurrency, and it is a different kind of a critter. You'll see also, by the way, one last thing is you'll see all kinds of people say, don't get involved with it for the following reasons. And every single one of their reasons are immaterial to the reasons you would want to get involved with it. So you'll see a lot of people touting Bitcoin. I'm not saying it's going to make you rich or anything. There will be people that will be made rich by it, certainly. My point is that it is an in-the-Fed strategy, and it aids a free humanity to get out from underneath the Zionist bankers. We don't need them, and they're bleeding us. Every single time you do a transaction in a bank, they take a fee. This is absurd. I want to give money across the planet. It shouldn't cost us money to do that transaction. And so, and they bleed us without adding value or productivity. So they're thieving from us. I follow a rule here that, you know, universe rewards you when you add value and everything else is theft. These guys are thieving.
Well, that's right. And scientists, they are indeed. So yeah, you got that right. Now, so in other words, you say you should not have your life savings in Bitcoin at this point if you can't spare it then, basically.
Correct. Correct. And also look at what it's for. It's a storehouse of wealth, yes, and it's going to escalate in price, yes, but it's really a currency and a medium of exchange. So if you want to store your wealth in absolute surety and safety, buy gold and silver or diamonds or land or something. I wouldn't go for land because it could be taken away from you in some jurisdictions, but, you know, something more portable. But, and then use Bitcoin as, an investment vehicle, a vehicle for moving and buying and purchasing and so on. It's there to be used, not held onto. It's going to be held onto and accumulated by some people for a little bit of period of time. But as I say, these new benefits are going to pop out and even they will be inclined to use the coins thereafter.
So it's, yeah, exactly. So it's not there for saving and accumulation and that it's correct. To purchase. It's a flow, currency that you want to buy, things.
Well, no, it's even more profound than that. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does that. But Bitcoin is for us to build the new world. And I'm not saying new world order, because that isn't going to happen. I'm saying we're on a new planet. Okay. The planet is expanding underneath our feet. Our consciousness is expanding as to where we are in our relationship to the universe and all the weird stuff that's going on. And Bitcoin is provided to us by universe at the appropriate time, just when we need it. And Bitcoin is an idea. So let them stop an idea if they can.
Right. Very good. Well, that's some good tips there. Now, to kind of change gears a little bit then, have you kept an eye on Comet Izon at all? Anything that's been coming up?
Yeah. I've been following it. I hear some of the stuff in English, but I've been following it more in Russian and Polish because there seems to be more hard evidential discussion of it there. Yeah, there's a lot of speculation and so on. And basically, there's a common thread across all the languages that Izon ain't no comet.
Tell us more.
Well, if we were just look at it linguistically, the number of people with degrees behind their names who are self-directed to use those degrees in internet conversations in this realm, that is to say these astrophysicists and stuff who identify themselves, you know, not just so someone in a forum, but people were able to track with some level of credentials. There is a very minority opinion that Izon is in any way like any other comet ever seen. And so at a base, we start off with the astrophysics community saying that fundamentally, Izon is not like any other comet we've ever encountered. And that it resembles, if we then take the next stage up, we see that some of these people have brought in their colleagues. And this in Russian, they brought in a lot of the archaeology and crypto knowledge people, what we would think of as mythologists. And these guys are saying, well, you know, the shapes and so on, this reminds us of these particular symbols used by these past cultures. And they use these symbols in relation to things that we think mean this. And so there's been a lot of discussion in Cyrillic about what it could be from an evidentiary-based place. Okay, so they're not just saying, well, we think it could be spaceships. They're saying, it's not a comet like we've ever seen. It appears to have split. It has wings of these types. It forms jets that are aperiodic and atypical to any other angular cometary jet we've seen as it approaches the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It has a core that has these characteristics that are unlike any other cometary core we've seen, including what may be three physical separate entities, if you will, within what we would assume to be a core. And now recently there's been an exploration of something slightly behind the core or hidden by it or within it. It's very difficult to ascertain by the people doing the investigation just exactly what they're looking at, but the space some slightly behind Izon does not look normal or regular. Let's put it that way. It also appears to have some kind of an object in it, in the sense of if we wanted to think about it a particular way, This one Russian guy really did a very good job of describing it. He said that he had this experience, but I'll just encapsulate it and say if we were thinking about ISON in a particular way, we could imagine ourselves looking at a big snowball, a giant snowball that's rushing at us. And we're standing in Russia when this guy is describing it. He's in the steppes. And here's this giant, huge snowball coming at him. And he said, you know, must have been 35 feet high. And he had no idea what this thing was. And then it dawned on him when he got this little tiny glimpse of the hardness behind this huge snowball. It was one of the snow throwing trains. And he got his ass out of that valley real quick. But he didn't know. And so in that sense, he's saying we could be looking at the snowball of ISON or whatever ISON is being pushed by something we can't see. Whether it's energetic or a physical body, we can't determine, but we do know from their understanding that light is and light is not behaving as it should, coming from whatever it is that is ever so slightly behind the core of ISON. And that, I think, has gotten everybody more intrigued recently than any of the other strangenesses with ISON, the sudden brightening. The Russians don't really, there's no common consensus that ISON changed course, for instance, in the Cyrillic or Polish communities. There is some acknowledgement that the Western press and some Western scientists seem to think that has occurred. There is an acknowledgement that the coma on Mars was altered and that the coma on the moons of Mars was altered by the transit of ISON. So this has generated a lot of excitement. You know, it's awful. Takes a lot of energy to change the coma on a planet.
Yeah, exactly. How did that happen? How do they visually see this, or measurements, or how do they?
No. It was measured through infrared telescopes.
All right.
So it's actually the coma is discussed on Mars. Its alteration was discussed in terms of brightness and orientation and length, which implied strength. And unlike one's supposition, the length was not drawn towards ISON and was not apparently pushed away, so there was no like repulsion. But it was lengthened by ISON's passage, but as an after effect. So that was quite odd. So it's not like they were reacting. Okay, the discussion around it is that there was no gravitational pull from ISON that was causing the coma on Mars to alter, that whatever the effect was, it was not gravitational as we understand it, because it in no way drew the coma towards ISON. And as ISON was passing, the coma lengthened directly in the same direction that ISON had come from.
Hmm.
If I said that right. So it's sort of like a little vacuum kind of an effect there.
Uh-huh.
And so that has everybody rather intrigued, because now I follow Dr. Bhatt, B-H-A-T. He's a Hindu fellow. He's a spiritualist, but he was also a scientist. And he came to the certain conclusions that are mathematically supportable, that we've never ever as a planet orbited the sun, that we don't have a heliocentric model of a solar system, that we in fact have a helical model, and we're all dragged behind the sun. And Western astronomers will tell you that this is the case, that there we do not orbit the sun. We're not at the equatorial plane. And if you get into them and really berate them on this, they'll tell you exactly that this has been proven and we know this. So, and that basically what I'm stating also is that all bodies in universe, in so near as we can tell, certainly within our galaxy and nearby galaxies, all bodies are cometary. Comets are the model, not the exception. And so Earth has a coma. The sun has a coma. We call it the heliosphere.
Mm-hmm.
We're within that heliosphere. It is my contention, after reading through Dr. Bhatt's material and other individuals, that vacuum only exists directly behind the sun, and that interstellar space is anything but a vacuum. In fact, it may be quite solid from our perception, at least in terms of energy. So I don't think the Voyager spacecraft, for instance, have yet left our solar system. They're still being dragged along in our cellular membrane, if you will, from our solar system.
And everything there, by the way, has turned out very contrary to what they believed, right? There was some
correct
strange forces and all kinds of stuff going on.
They thought, and it kept slowing down as it kept getting closer to the edge of what they thought was the solar system. Well, Guy, you know, it's like, duh, the material is thicker there. You know, it's not a vacuum. You're pushing these things through thicker material. And yes, none of it matched up what their expectations were, which was basically shoot a spaceship out and it would go out to interstellar space because there's nothing to stop it. On the other hand, now we know that that is not true at all. That basically we live in, if you will, a giant paramecium or other single-celled life that's whizzing along through some kind of a media and led by our nucleus, which we call our sun. And that's as good an analogy as anything else. And our sun is swimming in this media by methods and propulsion we're unaware of. We don't know what makes the sun move through the interstellar media, why it's being attracted to others. We say that, you know, there's gravity involved, but that's just a theory, a supposition. We have no real way of knowing what causes our sun to move. And we have some level of knowledge about how things work, but not the whys. And so these big gaps lead us into certain trouble. And in analyzing things, what I like to do is I like to look at discussions about things like ISON and some of these other issues from other languages. So I get a different perspective that isn't my own cultural bias. And that also so I can get outside of my own cultural matrix and get some different thinking on it. And then I like to do cross linguistic analysis to see what threads are there that are common. And then where are the extreme outlying differences, because frequently those guys turn out to be right. And so some of these guys are saying it was from there initially that there was this one guy about, I want to say August or so, that was saying, I think I see something right behind the center there. What is that? And from there, we've now got to the point where it's a pretty a solid consensus that the nucleus of ISON has something in it or some effect within it that is causing this particular artifact, and we can't tell the difference yet. We won't know until probably December when we're on the other side of it, or it's on the other side of us, as to what's in the middle or what was in the middle, because it'll be at a slightly different angle. We might be able to get some more intelligence out of it.
Well, these wings that they've seen, as you said, sprouted, is very interesting. Looks like a mushroom or something like that in certain pictures, you know, the way it's being spread out. But what about panspermia? I mean, comets as carriers of you know, new bacteria or new DNA, or at least the components, you know, for life's building blocks. And this has been, of course, heralded in the past as, you know, the looming new diseases or viruses, like kind of, you know, Andromeda strain style thing. Is there anything to that, do you think?
Actually, I don't think there's much to that, simply because of the what I'd said earlier was that we're in this barrier inside our solar system. We're much more at risk from bacteria from Mars, Jupiter, et cetera, than we would be from any outside of our solar system, because the ability of anything to get into our solar system is as limited as ours to get out. Now, here's some interesting things, though. There is a particular tribe in Africa called the Dogon, and these tribe in Africa hold the longest human memory of the central core myth that is at the center of all religions on the planet in some variants or another. The myth that the Dogon hold is about these creatures that were aquatic called the Nummo. And the Nummo came here in these ships that were propelled by what was called liquid copper. And the ships formed two wings outside as a central core as they went through the interstellar medium. They formed that after they came out of the interstellar medium and decelerated here in our solar system, according to the myths and the stories of the Dogon. And the liquid copper is always, in the Dogon understanding, a circle. It's the symbol is a circle with these two wings off of it, which we will also note is the Ahuas symbol for the Incas. It's in the Egyptian symbol. It's the held by a scarab frequently, and then it's got two wings off of it, the sun with two wings. All of these suns with two wings are found in Australian symbology. They're found in the Polynesians. We see it up here in the Pacific Northwest. And here in the Pacific Northwest, we have the uniqueness of a relatively untainted native tradition of stories and cultures. And the sun with the two wings on either side of it, the ships that are propelled by liquid copper, are distinctly the Nummo, and up here they are described as belonging to Changer. Now, Changer is the local name for the Nummo because they came and they changed all of our DNA and made us as we are now. And they are also at the basis for the external savior myth. They're the basis for the faith-based religions out of the Mideast. All of this is all goes back to Nummo and their understanding, or and the Dogon's understanding of how the Nummo reacted with us. And the thing about Ison and the wings is those actual photos I've seen, you can match those up against these damned Egyptian pictures and against the Dogon's symbology. And then there's this other interesting little wrinkle. This place that's near you guys, actually, south of you, some 1,800 kilometers or something in Turkey. Göbekli Tepe?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yep.
Okay, well, that is a finely carved book that describes exactly what the Nummo are stating. What the Dogon are stating, how the Nummo came here, how they took species, how they made other species out of it, and created all that it is here now. And if you look at each of one of those stelae in the stele in the individual layouts, most of which have not yet been examined, but the ones that have been examined tell a story. And I'm able to identify 15 that belong to one chapter, and then at least two other chapters from the other 40 plus that have been revealed. And so it's actually a pictographical representation, and that's why they buried it. They didn't want it lost. At the last expansion ice age period, it was deliberately buried by its creators in a very methodical fashion so it would be found by us. Unfortunately, we should have found it 3,000 years ago. We wouldn't be in this stew now with these damn banksters.
How would it change the course? Yeah.
Well, because we would understand that there is no that the faith-based religions are also based on the Nummos, and are you going to go on out and kill somebody for Allah when you find out that Allah or your Jehovah God or any of these things are based on the Nummo, and that in fact we are indeed an engineered species? It's like the mathematics of Bitcoin. You know, you don't argue with 2 + 2 = 4. If we all accept it as a common understanding where humans came from, imagine the power that gives us. If we all held that one thought, if we all knew where humanity came from in a true fashion, it would eliminate religion faster than space aliens showing up here. And it doesn't matter where we came from. We could have all been spurted out of a giant aerosol can by a passing space goat. And it doesn't matter as long as we understand that this is where we all originate. Our amnesia is what is causing the trauma and the problems that are besetting our social order these last 3,000 or 4,000 years and allowing the I don't have a particularly nice word for them, but the bastards to gain control. And it's because of this amnesia, because we don't have this common core understanding, that we have these gaps that allow these power structures. So if we had that, look at the power that gives us. And so if we look at the Ison myth or the Ison comet and match it up against the Nummo, maybe the Nummo are coming back. Now, there's something about the Nummo story. It actually has within it the second coming of Christ myth. It has the 12th Imam myth. It has all of the myths of the awakening of Brahma from the Hindu religion. It has in its core this return of the creator that is the spread and supports all of these other myths within these other religions. Because the Nummo are described as knowing, A, they screwed up, B, they had to leave us alone after a while to let us work out certain things to get to a certain stage, and C, they said they'd come back when we reached that certain stage so they could tell us the way things are. Now, it's just curious that we dug up Tepe in Turkey right at the point where we're in an expansion. This is actually one of the periods of time where we ought to be burying those things to save them from what we're going to be going through for the next 30 or 40 years. As the Earth gets all wonky and space starts throwing crap at us and strange things happen. This is a predictable pattern of Earth activity that's where they buried it the last time this stuff occurred, just to protect it. And here we dig it up just where it can be exposed and destroyed. Mm. It's kind of ironic in that sense. But we need to know. You know, we need to know and we need to accept this. It'll be a situation of where the old hardline religious mind control people will simply have to die. Because they won't be able to accept it. But once there's a common sense understanding of humanity's origin and it's accepted, then it will grow the same way we have this awake and aware movement that's growing, that's causing all the problems for the powers that be. And it's just an adjunct to that, because we're going to have to destroy their control myths. Oh, yes, you should worship the queen because, you know, divine right of rule. you should worship the Pope. Oh, because he's this, the bishop of this off-world alien god, who if you don't worship him, he's going to come back and kick your ass. And that's basically the message of the Bible, right? And so we'd get rid of all of that stuff because we would know, it was this set of circumstances that these aquatic beings came here because we're an ocean planet. And while they were here, because it is their nature, they wanted immortality they wanted eternity for the souls of the beings that were here. And it's kind of like, they're kind of like, to a certain extent, the religious proselytizers, the Nummo, to a certain extent, they're good Samaritans who couldn't help themselves. They know how to deal with DNA and create things. That's what they do. And they want to have solid souls that have a sense of eternity and immortality. And that's how they built us. But they screwed up along the way. There's the myths in the Dogon religion, and you can read it yourself. And it explains how they screwed up and how they were going to come back. And at the time that we had basically become self-correcting. And I think we're getting close. I think we're getting an understanding that basically of our own level of ignorance. And once we have that, hey, then all things are possible. As long as we keep saying we know something, boy, we're really screwed. So anyway, once we get to this level of ignorance where creativity bursts out like this, then there will be these common acceptances. And we'll find things like more evidence of Tepe, more evidence of the Dogon myth is factual. It'll be put together in a way that it'll all make sense. And maybe the Dogon will come on back because maybe it's that time. Or maybe the Nummo will come back.
Well, I got some splaining to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. But see, that's good. Because see, here's the thing, right? Space alien shows up. I'm not going to think he's a god. If I find out that this aquatic being is the Nummo, he's got some splaining to do. And we can deal with it as adults, as peer-to-peer, as equals, because it is soul-to-soul, regardless of their level of technology. So this is not a situation of Western cultures coming to the North America and the theoretic destruction of the native population by its contact with those Western cultures. You'll hear this brought up all the time in academic sciences. And they'll say, oh no, the planet Earth will never survive. Humanity will never survive contact with alien species because they'll be so advanced, we'll be like the Indians and we'll be wiped out. Well, let me tell you guys, the Indians were wiped out because of deliberate acts on the part of the Catholic Church to poison them with smallpox and other diseases. It was an act of aggression. It was invasion. It was not the clash of cultures. It was not a contextual issue where the savage Indian 30 plus million of them in this country at that time suddenly died simply because they couldn't take contact with the white man who had these funny hats and worshiped men in skirts. It was not that kind of a situation at all. These people poisoned these individuals. They came to this country knowing it was here and knowing that they were going to take it over. And so if we face space aliens like that, yeah, we got a big wall of hurt and a large obstacle to overcome. But short of that, there is no reason for us to kowtow because the Nummo operate at a soul level, in the sense a spirit level, right? And so all spirit, all life is equal. And they grasp that. As soon as we grasp that, then we elevate ourselves in power. Once you understand that there is no authority over me, anything any human did on this planet, if I'm consistent and dedicated enough, I too can achieve. I may die before I achieve because I'm an old fart, but I could sit down and teach myself nuclear engineering, brain science, any damn thing. And most people on this planet can do the same. When it comes down to a spiritual level, I'm very advanced. I've been doing meditation for years, and I know the level of critters that are out and about in the non-material world and some of their levels of strength. And I'm also quite shocked at the level of strength that a human mind can have under these circumstances in these same playing fields, if you will. And so I know that if faced with a space alien, if it's a soul-to-soul battle, hey, we'll give as good as we get. Mm-hmm. And it's a draw. Because we can't be defeated. We can simply be killed. And we're basically immortal. We're eternal. We're not immortal in the sense that my body's going to live forever. And in fact, that would be quite a disgusting thing indeed. Better I should change the battery out of my phone or change the vessel I sail around in periodically so I get a new one, right?
Right.
Housekeeping. And so I grow with the times and merge with the times. And so in that sense, we are eternal because we recycle continuously. And there's no myth about this. This is mathematically provable. And, you know, it's just a question of the religious basis for denial of reincarnation, which is, by the way, a recent invention, the denial of reincarnation. And it's actually recorporeation, not really in reincarnation, because reincarnation would imply that you would take a level of your current memories and stuff and act on them. And that's rarely the case for a number of different reasons. But so under the circumstances, if space aliens, including the Nemo, show up here, it's like, okay, Nemo, you're really damned advanced and you are indeed our ultimate creators way back when, but it does not matter now because I'm as eternal as you are. And, you know, Lucy, you got some splaining to do.
Well, that's always been the point as well, that, you know, even though you might be able to meddle with DNA and genetically alter, much like mankind can do right now, it doesn't mean that they are the inventors of it. You know, it doesn't make them God. It's just it's an engineer to a certain degree that has managed to do it. Is that the case, do you think? Is that the level where, what is that? Or were we developed for a specific reason by them, do you think?
No, I don't actually buy that. You'll see that myth thrown around the New Age community and throughout the woo-woo community, the Awake and Aware community, where we are engineered to be slaves and we're a slave species and all of this. Mm-hmm. I actually think there's a lot of reasons for these people in those communities to think this and to believe it. And I think that the Anunnaki and all of that kind of stuff is recent, okay? The Nemo created us, Changer created us, as the Salish would say, way back when. And since then, we've had other visitors that have laid claim to those creations and have mucked about with them. But it was Nemo that did the original work and brought us into existence. The Anunnaki and the idea that, for instance, Michael Tellinger has, that we were slave species for mining gold in Africa and so forth, there's a lot to suggest that he has some elements correct. Did the Anunnaki create us? No. The Gilgamesh myth derives from, which is the basis for the Bible and for the understanding of who the Anunnaki are and all of this, derives from Sumerian, what we call Sumerian. They didn't call themselves that. It's what the Jewish religious scholars call that society, is the Sumerians. But in any event, the Gilgamesh myth predates that entire region and goes all the way back again to Nemo, and it was just altered when it went through the Babylonian sphere, because I think that's where these actual space aliens had shown up and said, hey, these people are ignorant of the Nemo having created them, so let's step up and say we did it. They'll never know. They're a bunch of rubes. And, you know, we're showing up here in our big Roch, which we call in our Bible Holy Spirit, but actually means spaceship that can float over water, as opposed to those that can't, apparently. And so they showed up in their Roch, their Holy Spirits, and set about trying to claim that they were God and that they'd created us. And so we have basis for people today to think this and to buy into these adaptations and modifications, if you will, of the underlying myth. But I don't think that they actually did create us. In fact, I don't think they mucked around with us very much at all. In terms of their DNA ability, whereas the Changer myth, the Dogon and the local Salish and the Polynesian population and the Australian population that have all been holding these stories together, their understanding of the Nemo and their interaction with things is extremely profound and very detailed. There's no detail in any of the Gilgamesh stuff. It's just this glossed over abstraction, if you will. But if you get into the other levels, you get real detail and you know you're looking at some level of truth. So all of the faith-based religions based on the Gilgamesh story and that level of interaction with our species, I find to be less than credible, although they may indeed have happened and have simply been distorted.
What do you think the Nemo did to us then? Did they take, you know, part monkey, part themselves, or is it a completely different scenario?
Different scenario entirely. Here's the thing. From my viewpoint, we live in what's known, what I describe as the materium, okay? Now, this is an adaptation of the thought expressed by Buckminster Fuller. The thought that he expressed was that a universe existed, universe being this concept that does not mean God. The universe is clearly defined by Buckminster Fuller as being the sum total of all human experience from its very beginning until its very end. Obviously, we haven't reached the end of all human experience yet, so we're within universe. And so In that sense, what I say is, universe is the sum total of all human experience beginning to end, and it is happening within, or part of it is happening within what I call the materium. And that is where matter is perceived. And I say perceived because matter does not exist. There is only energy. And so there's this 22 trillion times a second or 46 trillion times a second pulse and antipulse that go on that create the illusion of movement and matter. And that is where we have this human experience that we call universe. And I call that place the materium. And so within the materium, the understanding of things like what the Nummo were doing, where they started from, you have to understand that our science doesn't understand how creation actually happens. They think there was this big bang way back when, and every atom that was ever created has existed and is persistent. Nothing could be further from the truth. No atom exists now. It's all energy. The energy is continuously recreating itself 22 trillion times a second. And it is this understanding of the energetic nature of universe, which will have you understand that DNA spontaneously appears. I'm not saying like spontaneous generation of flies or anything from, you know, those kind of myths, but rather that the hydrogen atom pops into existence, the hydrogen ion pops into existence at a certain level of vibration. And as these vibrations increase, the hydrogen ion, as we perceive it, increases in density. And what we're actually seeing is, and we even describe it that way, that there's more nucleuses in more nuclear material in a uranium-238 atom than there is in helium or hydrogen, you know, by vast numbers. And it's heavier, it's denser, it has a greater, if you will, density of vibration, with the hydrogen atoms having a smaller level of vibration or a higher level of vibration, less dense. And so we acknowledge this even in our speech about how we describe solid matter. But we can prove to ourselves very easily that solid matter doesn't exist. And you can do this by taking a cup of coffee and going to a laboratory table and pouring the coffee on a table, or pour coffee on formica, or pour coffee on a piece of wood that's been varnished, or in fact, the varnish itself. If there were solid matter, how is it the varnish can penetrate into the wood? If there is solid matter, how is it the formica can be stained? You know, theoretically, those atoms are immutable. They exist there. They haven't been changed. And, you know, if you actually try and get a material science to explain staining, you get off into some really wild-ass guessing that goes on. But it's very simple to understand if everything is energy at various different levels of vibration. They're merely intermingling because there is no such thing as solidity. And the stain is actually becoming part of that surface as we perceive it, because much of all of this is perception.
You know, I've actually wondered that too. Sometimes you have a, you know, slab of marble or something like that, and you have a, you know, wet mug or something standing on it. It leaves that circular mark. And you're like trying to get it off and, you know, scrub it off. And it's like, what's going on there?
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that stone supposed to be atoms?
Yeah,
isn't
exactly.
It supposed to be immutable? Yeah.
That's an interesting point.
Nothing is immutable. All things are energy. And so if everything is energy, then our consciousness is energy as well. And at this point, it's discrete. Your consciousness is discrete from me. I'm discrete from my dog, etc. But we're all consciousness. All life is equal at that level, which leads naturally to, the understanding that vegetarianism is probably the better route to go because of the vibrational issues, if nothing else. But in any event, so here along come the Nummo, and they're also operating at this vibrational level. They understand the materium. They understand that atoms are popping, energy is popping into existence continually. That's the way the materium works. It's expanding, increasing in complexity, increasing in energy as more and more life becomes involved in the middle of it. And that gets into a whole level of other discussion, but not going there, just dealing with the Nummo's understanding. Here the materium is expanding. There's more energy happening all over. They can actually twist out of that energy any atom or DNA configuration they should desire using their technology. They need not have a base under, they need not have a soup to start with, if you will. They can create the soup, right? There's this joke that my wife told me the other day, and it's a good joke for a religious joke. And I'll tell it to you now and then tell you why it's absolutely true. DNA scientists and everybody all get together and decide, okay, we're as powerful as God. We can, us humans, we can do anything God can do. We can make electricity, we can make lightning, we can even make life. And so they say, we're going to just get rid of God. So they send this representative and he goes on up to God and says, God, y'all take a hike. And God says, you know, we can do what you can do. And God says, okay, well, all right, I'm willing to take a hike, but you prove it. And the guy and the DNA scientist, the scientist there says, okay, all right, what do you want to do? And God says, well, tell you what, let's us have a man-making competition. Let's both of us make a man. And the guy says, okay. The human says, okay, I agree. And God says, just to make it real interesting, let's do it the original way, the way I did.
Yeah.
And so the man, the scientist, reaches down and grabs a bit of mud down there. That's when God looks at him and says, uh-uh, you got to make your own mud.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, See, there's the thing. Nummo know how mud is made. Nummo made the mud.
They building don't have blocks, though.
Correct. They just allow the energy to come on through, and they twist it into hydrogen, helium. They create the G, C, A, and the other components of our DNA as they choose. All they needed to know was the knowledge. And here we know from the Dogon myths about the Nummo that indeed this is the case, because there was this Frenchman long before computers existed, long before a lot of our modern technology existed, in the 30s, 20s and 30s, who went and talked to the Dogon and wrote all this stuff down. His name was, I think it's Grimaule, I think.
French anthropologist, I believe.
French anthropologist, yeah. Right. He was talking to some of the Dogon, and he was asking them all about this kind of stuff, and they told him stuff that was absolute fact, that the Nummo showed up here, and they had, in a little tiny cube, they had all of life. They had all of the life that was going to ever exist on this planet in this little tiny cube. And the Frenchman says, oh, you're full of it. How can this little tiny cube hold that? And they said, well, it could hold an infinite amount. And they could not get the idea across to this Frenchman, because he had no concept of the idea of digital storage of information, and that you didn't need to have the soup, you just needed to have the recipe. And that the Dogon were saying, the Nummo showed up here with a little cube with bazillions of recipes. And so all they had to do was choose the recipe to make the life they wanted. They didn't actually need any of the base material. And the Frenchman just couldn't quite get it across. He couldn't understand it because of his cultural matrix. But now we grasp what what they were trying to communicate to him at that point, that indeed the Nummo had a little tiny cube that had infinite capacity to store life. And every new life they invented, every new recipe they came up with, it also stored that. And they could take it with them. And the poor Frenchman was left just so bewildered, because he just could not grasp this idea. But of course, these days, you know, USB port, backup, right? And so that's what we're looking at. And so a lot of this stuff now makes sense in a different fashion. And so when I see ISON, bringing it back to that, mm-hmm. and saw recently that it had sprouted the two wings and had the feathered tails, I keep looking at this as the feathered serpent, you know, the return of Quetzalcoatl, the Amu disc, the scarab supported disc that was the copper boat that the Egyptians referred to the creators as having. So may indeed be that, you know, Nummo are coming back. Now, if they do indeed come back, I'm afraid, the powers at the top, you know, the powers that be, are going to act like assholes.
So the post 2012 miss is still active and alive, really, then.
Oh, yes. No. And actually, that, you know, there was a lot of the hype there, the December 21 and all of that. And I would say that, you know, given the nature of the rapidity of change, that we certainly crossed a threshold about that time, that we certainly reached certain momentum points that have escalated rapidly since then, as though we had indeed sort of crossed into a downward slope, if you will, where change momentum was really going to ramp up. And every day seems to bring more change. In some ways, a lot of times we say everything stays the same. But at the same point, yes, the guy sitting on his couch is going to see the same TV. He's going to drink the same kind of beer. He's going to be totally unaware of it. But if you were just sort of get up and look about, you would see that, for instance, you know, China has cut off the United States debt. China has decided that there's got to be an un-Americanization of the planet. Saudi Arabia is pissed at the U.S. and is in the process of cutting off relationships with us, and is going to destroy the petrodollar, whether China does it or not, because they're so pissed at us. And so, you know, all this stuff is going on, and the change level is accelerating, but there's a complacency an ignorance on the part of the sheeple. Mm. And the real problem is, I've run into one of these guys before, the sheeple, I mean. Years ago, I happened to be in a situation where I had to take a lot of clothes over to a local laundromat. And this was like probably 2006 or something.
I run into them more often than that, but go ahead.
No. This guy was just, I see him all the time. However, I try and avoid but in any event, sure. This guy was just really a particularly egregious example of it, mm-hmm. because I never really understood the kill the messenger business before, right? Because I'm an intelligent fellow. You tell me something, I can accept it or not as I choose. And I don't react badly just because you tell me something that I don't necessarily want to hear. But in any event, I was over there and I was just chatting with the guy who owns the laundromat while the clothes were drying. And this other fellow happened to hear, and we were discussing Codex Elementis, which was the attempt to ratchet down the availability of health supplements here in the United States, theoretically based on a EU movement towards the same effect, right?
Yep.
And I just happened to mention that, oh yeah, they're coming for your supplements, you know, them badass bastards, just, you know, mouthing off the way I usually do. And talking to the owner there, and this other guy just got very, very, very upset. He was a local radio host at a local college, and he almost came to blows. He almost, for whatever, you know, I know the reason now. He had a cognitive dissonance level of distortion in his mind when I told him this, and his mind, in order to preserve itself, needed to pummel me into retracting those words so it didn't hear that. And that is the reaction I'm very much afraid of the sheeple. Is that there are going to be a lot of people in a lot of circumstances, especially here in the United States, where they've been dumbing us down for decades. And these people are dumb. They're very ignorant. They're not aware of what's going to happen. And it will happen to them suddenly. They will react very badly because they will have no skills and very few opportunities to do other than that. And the powers that be are going to attempt to use those bad reactions to shovel everything into their version of the controlled planet.
Oh yeah.
I don't think it's going to happen, but I think there's that the chaotic influences of the time will overcome that. You know, I don't think it'll be order out of chaos. I think chaos rules. Hmm. And I think we're just going to become more chaotic and get more used to it. But in the meantime,
well, chaos is not a bad thing either. That's another misconception. It's a nice order in the seeming chaos out there, you know? So
and there's opportunity. And if we look at what's happened, the more they ratchet down control, the less
worse it gets. Yeah.
The less growth, the less dynamism of our country.
That's right.
There is no benefit to this except for this narrow top group that exists because they suck energy out of the rest of us.
Yeah. Bottom up self-organization. That's the way to go. Decentralize, you know, just pick that system apart and things will have a wonderful, just magnificent, almost semi-magical, but not really, it's natural, but a natural balance to it, where people even self-organize in systems, yeah, which is intelligent and it's going to work, you know?
I know. You see things in nature. It is just, you know, like cascading bubbles and how bubbles react as triangular entities overcoming barriers and stuff. And these marvelous examples of basically strange engineering that we don't really examine. But there's other aspects of this too that are quite fascinating, and that is that sitting back sort of in an observer mode, we see that these anti-waves, unless you go and look for them and know what to look for, which I have my linguistic tools, which gives me a real edge. I knew, for instance, that there was going to be a potential for an anti-wave, and it would concentrate on exercise. And it would be people that would be fanatically devoted to exercise, and as a subset of that, fanatically devoted to their food sources. And indeed, I found it by tracking Bruce Lee, because Bruce Lee exhibited both of those characteristics. There's a characteristic that Bruce Lee shares with Bob Marley and Che Guevara, that wherever you find major social themes and change, you will find posters of these three individuals. Whether it's revolution, whether it's internally generated extreme calisthenics, because of the revolutionary nature and because of the revolutionary nature of the self-discipline that must be imposed by any of those, you know, the Rastafarian music, you know, but also the Bruce Lee's fanatic devotion to his diet and his body. And, you know, it just sort of made sense. And so I tracked Bruce Lee around, and then it was like, aha, there we go. I found a particular group of people talking about these particular posters, and I identified them maybe in 2003 or 2004. And indeed, they've grown into this extreme calisthenics movement, which is growing very rapidly. And it has a lot going for it in terms of selling it into a younger generation, that are even the schlubs, the couch potatoes that are, you know, dying from their McDonald's diets, because many of these individuals are recognizing the poor health that they're in. And especially now that we've run into, you know, the fiasco of the health insurance issues here in the United States mm-hmm. under Obamacare, you know, I mean, this has brought it all to a greater level of focus. And many of the people within the extreme calisthenics, of course, actually, because of their age group and everything, they're out in there and they're saying, to hell with healthcare, I have health.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's a good point. Why the one that's going to provide your health is yourself. That's the bottom exactly. line. You have to be responsible exactly. for that. You can't just sit around and wait for someone else to like tell you what to do or how. But again, that's just part of that, you know, slave, you know, cradle from you know, cradle to grave kind of a system that is there to cater to you, all your needs all the time. The crutches are there. It's like, you know, we have to wake up and start, you know, walking around on our own legs here to be able to understand.
The rub, yeah. And this is you're quite correct. And here in the United States, in a way that you guys will be able to observe from outside, and we'll be living through it. And so I probably won't hear anywhere near as much as you will. But we're in a situation where the cradle to grave is bankrupt. Absolutely egregiously bankrupt, raped over, pillaged, robbed, you know, the last little bit of gold dust scraped out, the teeth looted, everything bankrupt. And it will not be very long before that bankruptcy becomes very self-evident. And then we're going to go through a sudden crash for all of the sheeple as they realize that they've been living on the largesse of the planet, which isn't coming in anymore, and they're going to have to adapt. And so I imagine there will be quite the die-off here as our healthcare system literally shutters to a stop and hospitals close and we hit this huge wall of dysfunction. And we'll emerge from the dysfunction, there's no doubt of that, and we'll probably be a kick-ass in 50 or 60 years when we've got a whole new manufacturing base underneath us with a technology that will leapfrog whatever is out on the planet now, because that's just the way it works. But we're going to go through some really hard times here. And the sheeple are going to be suffering at the greatest level.
I think you're right, you know, Cliff, because it's a good point again. This idea that there is cycles and patterns here. It waxes and wanes, and even the downfall that we see right now is going to lead way to a tremendous uprising again at some point. And I think you're right. I think that new industries and completely new ways of building things, inventions, what have you, those are going to take root in a country like the U.S. where, you know, when things are bad enough, I mean, as we know, I mean, the time of crisis is mankind's greatest, you know, point in time. That's when they really sparkle and do stuff that they've never done before. And that's why those moments are so essential and important to the human experience. Otherwise, we would never, you know, try any harder, right? We'd just be
correct,
contemplative,
correct.
You know, it's like nothing else.
Well, biology teaches us no organism grows without irritation.
It's true.
It doesn't move unless you poke it. You poke that paramecium, it'll move. You know, so yeah. No, and we have to grow through suffering. And boy, we're going to grow really well because we've got a lot of suffering we got to go through. Plus, we have some karmic debts here, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a populace, we've allowed this situation. Yes, we were manipulated. Yes, we're slaves. Yes, we're stupid. And once we wake up, we can eschew ourselves of responsibility for what we were like when we were asleep. We can say, cut ourselves some slack and absolve ourselves from participation at that level as long as we stop participating. But there will always be this level of guilt. So for instance, my father participated, my livelihood, my life up until the time I left that house was supported by his participation in the death business as a professional soldier enforcing the corporate policies of our national state. He didn't recognize, I think, maybe he did because of the circumstances. We never really had a chance to talk about it. But he may not have recognized for most of his adult life his participation as an enforcer for corporate dictates. He did know that Vietnam was absolutely bogus, that there was never any Gulf of Tonkin, and that the whole thing was a sham. And that really upset him, even though he was there three times in three tours. And it was, that kind of thing, those kind of levels of guilt are interfamilial and travel down the lines of the family. So I share some of that, right? Mm-hmm. So in my way of thinking, the powers that be owe me a soul debt for the damage that's been done to my personal family. Now, I'm saying here, I'm, you know, not dealing with anybody else's issues. I'm just dealing with them myself. We've lost so many males out of my lineage to war because the nature of my body type and my DNA is that we're good fighters, we're warriors. And so, you know, most of them have been stupid and have all died fighting for these corporate entities that control our country. But that's changed now. And so in that change, though, I have to be acknowledged. I have to acknowledge to myself that I don't want to create a Palestinian versus Jew kind of issue that goes on generations long after the initial conflict is over, mm-hmm. perpetuating nothing but death and horror for everyone. Right. Admittedly, we have to say that the Israelis, independent of the Jewish people, the Israelis are acting as buttheads and oppressors of the and occupiers of Palestine, and they deserve anything that they're going to get. But we need not carry that beyond this generation when we absolve it. So when I get retribution, I don't know that I want blood retribution from the powers that be, but I want change retribution so that no other family in the future should have to no one else should have to come up and say, you know, every meal I ate came from the death and suffering that, you know, as payment for death and suffering inflicted on other people. Up until the time that, you know, I became awake and aware and left that circumstance. And so there is that karmic debt that I will take with me back to the materium when I recycle my soul and I deal with all of this. And that's an interesting process as well, because there's power that's available there. I'm determined that, you know, even as a martyr, should they kill me, I will extract my revenge on the powers that be by getting this thought out there that they owe me that karmic debt and I'm coming to claim it one way or another. Now, I happen to be very educated, although not schooled. I have no degrees. And, you know, in a sense, I was very intelligent, but I barely made it through the social constraints of what we call high school here. And so I did graduate there. But from then on, it was just education for my own purposes. But I know a lot of smart dead guys, and I read their books all the time. And there's this one real smart dead Chinese fellow, and he wrote this book called The Art of War. And he says that the ultimate, you can read through there, it's a fascinating book, everybody should read it. We're at war at the moment. We're going to be at war for another 40 years as we get rid of the powers that be. And we need to know this business of war very diligently, because it applies to all different kinds of life issues. It gives you good principles to operate on, to think about things. But one of the things he says in there when facing an enemy is that the ultimate way of fighting is to attack an enemy's plans. So, for instance, I as an individual living out here in the woods can in no way influence what the state of Israel can do, their impact on the planet or anything. But if I got wind of one of their plans far enough ahead of time, I could use one of these Taoist approaches that he who knows the plans of the enemy can make things happen a thousand miles away with a casual word. And I can start saying, boy, you know, those Israelis, they got this plan, they're going to do this. It's going to come to no good. It's going to work out very badly. And I would attack their plan and degrade and alter their plan and thus have a larger effect on the planet as a whole. There's a whole lot of people that are recognizing that that power truly exists. And we're taking advantage of that. And as you notice, say since like 2003, certainly in 2006 onward, the powers that be are really struggling. They've got real problems. The bail-ins are a sign of it. You know, the whole fiasco of the financial system 2008. They've got all kinds of issues. And it's not simply because of the cycles that we were discussing, but also because people like myself are harmonizing with those cycles and doing smart things like Alex Jones. Alex Jones doesn't go out and parade around with weapons other than his bullhorn. Okay, he attacks the plans of the enemy, and he's very dangerous because he's very effective. Same thing with David Icke. Same thing with Max Kaiser. Same thing with you guys. Now, admittedly, David Icke, Max Kaiser, Alex Jones are a bit more aggressive and have a certain level of focus that you guys don't, but we all contribute.
What do you mean with that level of focus? We have a good level of focus.
No, you have a good level of focus, but they are very, let's say they're aggressive. Okay. You're much more examining of the nature of the material.
Well, you know, just because we don't implement the same strategy as everyone else doesn't mean that we are less decisive or intent on the outcome of what we try to achieve here. understanding before action is key here. There are way too many people running around trying to fix the world before they've even taken the time to understand anything about it. So that calls for the necessity to be more contemplative.
Correct. Okay. Whereas they've done the contemplation, as have I. They're beset by certain problems, and they've decided contemplation is over, and they have to be aggressive about dealing with those problems. And so we find ourselves in different circumstances, even though we're fellow travelers and we're walking down the same road. Over on my side of the road, I got a bunch of bandits you don't have on your side. So I'm fighting a little bit different battle at the moment. That's all. But in any event, by attacking the plans, we're able to undermine these people. And it's all an information war. And hopefully we can come through this period of time with as few violent deaths as possible, because on the other side of it is a renaissance that will just stagger anybody that's able to live through the next 30 or 40 years. I mean, if we think we've seen change now, the combinatoric, as you were mentioning, like the makers community, okay, 3D printers is just the start of it. The open source hardware from Arduino, all of the ideas that are floating around, but it is the synergistic combination of all of these things where everybody's piggybacking on each other's invention and getting it out there as rapidly as they can, and they're not worrying about things like patents and copyrights and this sort of thing. They're getting out on YouTube and saying, hey guys, look what I did. Look how cool this is. Here's how it works.
Yep.
And then the next guy says, well, you know, he says, George, or, you know, hey, look, I've done this and I've done that even better. And, you know, and then Fred gets in there, and then you got Cindy. The next thing you know, you've got a hell of a device that, you know, everybody's replicating. And so we're leapfrogging. And that level of combinatoric synergistic approach, as I say, is just going to stagger everybody. And I actually think that that's what the powers that be are more afraid of than anything, is that particular aspect of chaos, because they can't control that. They can't even suck the life out of it or live off of it.
So you don't think that chaos that we see, including the failure of the economic system, everything, is a plan, a strategic plan to cause this chaos that they want to enforce in order to come in with a solution, if you will, to fix this?
I think you're partially correct. I think that they wish to harmonize with chaos that they knew would exist. They knew that we would reach this particular time, and they want to force us down a particular road that maintains their control by getting us into a world war. And if we kill each other off, there's fewer of us, and then they maintain control through their dead instruments the way they have these past 100+ years. Mm-hmm. But no, the chaos and the failure of the system is not engineered. It's happening because of the nature of things. So, for instance, as we're talking about cycles, you know, you bomb the crap out of Germany and Japan. Are you surprised when they rebuild? Are you surprised that they rebuild from the current state of technology and grow forward?
Yeah.
As opposed to duplicating. Why should they go back to the old industrial age and duplicate iron foundries, you know?
Yeah.
Makes no sense at all. They go right to titanium. If you know how to do it, why bother to recreate this old stuff?
It's like a forest burning down, you know, that gives, you know, new opportunities with new trees and new plants, and it grows like ever and never before in some of those areas.
And you even get mutation as a result.
That's
correct.
Right. Yeah.
And new opportunities, exactly. So that's exactly what's going to occur here. The United States has been basically, we've lost World War III, and we're a internally conquered nation with our resources stripped just the way Japan and Germany were. And we're going to go through an economic chaos period just the way Japan and Germany did. And then we'll come out the other side probably 20 years later, 19 years later, just the way they did, in a much better state, and will actually be probably the new United States. It won't be the current political system and those guys and the cobble the way we've got now. But the new United States will be, I think, very harmoniously participatory. We're not going to be dominant, but we're going to be key players in things because we've had this 60+ years of the secret labs and stuff going on, reverse engineering all the space alien hardware and that kind of crap. Mm-hmm. And so we'll bring that to the party once the citizens of our country have, you know, gone into those damn holes and beaten the crap out of the control freaks and said to the scientists, y'all come out and tell us what you know.
Well,
it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Well, I don't doubt it. And I hope so. I mean, that's like, you know, something has to has to give. You know, it can't just roll on and on the way it does or has been for so many years now. So, yeah.
I know. And see, here's the thing, Guy. It already has broken loose. And the very thing we were talking about way back in the beginning, the Bitcoin is an example of that. Once the money is altered, once that changes everything, because that is the basis for the power structure. And the power structure altered with those two elements, with the Chinese national yuan price for Bitcoin going over 1,000 and maintaining that, and then with the Chinese government coming out and saying that they're going to not buy American debt anymore, they've had it. And those two items shifted the whole balance of power. It was as though truly an empire died that particular moment. And it's just so big, it doesn't know it. It's going to fall over here in a little while. I actually think it'll fall over by April.
It takes, you know, the bigger the construct you have, the longer the demise of it takes, you know, similar to the Roman Empire took a couple of hundred years for it to collapse because, you know, the information wasn't as quick as it is now. But I still think it will take, you know, some time for something like this to collapse. It just doesn't happen overnight, you know.
No, it's going to take 2 months. We know this from recent examples, okay? Technocratic societies with the level of mass communications, once the blood is shut off for the consciousness of that society, once the brain has been killed, so to speak, it takes 2 months for it to fall apart. That's what happened with Argentina. Any of the current, even engineered fiascos in Libya and Egypt and all of this. There was a little brief flurry. 2 months later, 2 months later, there's a huge amount of change and revolution in the street. And a lot of it, of course, is economic. Again, in the Arab Spring, it was all driven by the economic and the basically everybody starving because of the destruction of the dollar. And so we've had the destruction of the dollar as far as it can possibly go. Currencies have been debased as far as they can possibly go. And we know this because China says, no more. We're not going to take any more. And in fact, there's so much not going to take any more that now the Chinese government is in the position of supporting Chinese movement into Bitcoin. They're clearing the way, regulatory, they're allowing people to be taxed, do real estate movement, pay for things in Bitcoin, and then they're letting the corporations there within their country decide to accept it as they choose. And so that alone tells me, those two elements right there tell me that everything changed that particular time, and the empire here in the United States had the blood supply cut off at the carotid artery, and so it'll be a couple of months before we keel over, and that's because our money will dry up. We can only monetize our debt if others are willing to buy it. Once we start monetizing our own debt and then buying our own debt, you're basically eating your own excrement. And that can't go on too long, right? There's no nutrition in it. Yeah. There's no there that gets you through to the next day.
Yeah.
And that's what's been going on. So if we look at Argentina from a particular point, it was actually 64 days later, their government collapsed, and then they started having, you know, a new president every week, the Casseroli revolution, the heckling of the politicians, their money system broke down, and it was about, like I say, 63 or 64 days after certain issues occurred within their bond market. Ours occurred the other day when China said, we're not going to buy anymore.
It's going to be a very interesting period. There's no doubt about that. There's so many different factors in terms of how this is going to, you know, come together. And I also think, you know, as I said before, out of that chaos, out of that environment, specifically when it comes to the U.S. because of the, well, you know, the fighting spirit of the people and the, you know, the cultural background to the people who left their own home countries to do, you know, try something different, and of course now their descendants there has a fighting spirit. And I think we're going to see some great stuff coming out of that system, you know, after that residual collapse, if you will, have kind of settled a little bit. So
I think we're going to do great. Another way of phrasing it, the way I like to look at it is, since we're the melting pot, we don't have this, you know, uniracial approach to things or unicultural. We go back to the biologist's first rule of growth. You know, no organism grows without irritation. We got a lot of irritation in this country, so we're going to do a lot of growing.
That's good. Well, it's been another interesting discussion, Cliff. I want to thank you so much again for coming back on the program and talking with us. I'm going to do some homework here on Bitcoin tonight, so I know what I'm doing. Please give us some of the details again, Cliff, in terms of the website, of course, and the Alta reports, and if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with before we wrap things up.
Sure. Our ALTA reports are forecasts of future behavior based on linguistic trends. I picked up trends for Bitcoin years and years and years ago. There's also a lot of it in this particular recent ALTA report about Bitcoin. So it's worth looking at just for that. Our site is halfpasthuman.com. If you want to look at the Bitcoin address on our site and pay me and make me a fair, ship me some, you know, what you think is fair in Satoshis based on the current price of it. We set a price in US dollars of $27.50 for this report. So, you know, take a guess as what Satoshi is going to be at the time you send it to me. If it's fair, we'll send you a report. If not, I'll let you know about it. So no problems there on denomination amounts in terms of numerals. Half Past Human, the ALTA report is covering 2014 quite extensively. We've done some things this last ALTA report. We've eliminated these two entities and merged them. For a long time, because of the nature of the political stuff that was going on here, I'd kept the Populous USA entity separate from Global Pop. But there's no linguistic reason to do so anymore, so it's merged back into Global Pop. It's just a subset now. It's no longer the American Century, so it actually became more meaningful for me to merge them back in and view us as an integrated whole and to start talking about the American population as an integrated whole within a subset of the global population and not even a dominant subset, because the USA, as the United States here, surviving the death of the American financial empire, we need to re-envision ourselves on the planet, and we still need to be aggressive. We still need to be participatory. We're going to have a lot of irritation. We're going to grow a lot. We'll be able to aid a lot, but we've got a lot of our own internal issues to work out. And so I think we need to start looking at our own internal debate, and any, expats, you know, hey, contribute. You're going to have a very good view of what's going on, because you can see us from outside. Anyway, halfpasthuman.com, ALTA reports, 2750 or appropriate Satoshi's address on the main site. And there's tons of other stuff there if you really want to get into the stuff to read. And we have audio and essays and that kind of stuff.
Right. Very good. We're going to have all the links up on redhascreations.com. Check out the ALTA reports. Well, glad to have you back again. Thanks so much, Cliff, for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very great. Sorry to keep you up so late.
All right. That wraps her up for today. A big thanks to all our members and everyone at Red Eyes, as usual. We'll be back with Andreas Bachmeier and then Judy Byington later this week. I hope you have a great rest of your day or evening, and we'll talk in just a few days. Take it easy.